I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. And if you're among the millions of Americans who's been ordering everything online you need to stay socially distanced, here's something to consider. Nearly 20,000 Amazon workers have contracted the coronavirus since the pandemic began, and so far 10 people have died. Those numbers stand in stark contrast to new television ads that feature a different side of the experience of being an Amazon worker.
To all of our Amazon retail heroes, on the floor, in the air, and behind the wheel, we want to thank you. We'll continue to do everything we can to keep you healthy, safe, and protected. The work you are doing means everything right now. Thank you.
As the holiday season approaches and more Americans are expected to order their gifts online, some Amazon workers across the country are attempting to organize for better working conditions. But that's had mixed results so far.
You know, business as usual. You know, and this is such a juggernaut of a company. You know, it's so hard to put a dent in their operations, even with all the boycott advocating that we've been doing. They put profits above people all the time. So once again, it's going to be a very busy, probably the most busiest peak season thus far for Amazon employees. I can only imagine.
That was Chris Smalls, an Amazon worker who says he was fired for trying to organize his colleagues at an Amazon warehouse in New York City. And we're going to hear more from Chris in a moment. We're talking about Amazon workers' unionization efforts and the company's response. Lauren Kaori Gurley is a staff writer at Motherboard, Vice's technology website. Lauren, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Tanzina. Thank you for having me.
What were the conditions for warehouses and workers at the peak of the pandemic, at least here in New York, back in March and April?
At the beginning of the pandemic, Amazon announced that it would be providing hazard pay to its workers. So $2 extra an hour. At Amazon, the minimum wage is $15 an hour. And they also announced that you could call out sick basically any time. But pretty quickly, lots of people got sick. So Amazon's warehouse in Staten Island was one of the first Amazon warehouses in the country to really take a hit. And I think one of the big problems that workers had was that they had no idea like how many people in their work site had tested positive. They were still positive. Like they'd get these text messages and phone calls that would sort of announce each time, but they wouldn't know, you know, what the name, I mean, for privacy reasons, Amazon didn't share the name of the person. And so they would have no idea like really if they had come into contact with them. So I think there was a lot of fear and a lot of questions that were unanswered. Workers really felt they wanted to hold Amazon accountable for sharing this data, and Amazon wasn't complying.
I mean, we know that back at the height of the pandemic, again, here in New York, because the pandemic is peaking across the country and other states right now, workers at Amazon wanted to strike. Have they gotten better working conditions right now?
There hasn't really been any, like, I guess there was a walkout on May 1st, which is May Day, but there hasn't really been any like massive strike across the country. There have been walkouts at individual facilities that are still going on. There was one a week or two ago in Minnesota, in Chicago, and there's been some in New York. Amazon, like I said, they cut off hazard pay like just as things were getting bad in the rest of the country, and they haven't reinstated it. Amazon loves to tout all of its health and safety measures it's taking, but I don't really feel like people feel more protected. They really are upset that they don't have that hazard pay, and you know that they're risking their lives and their families' lives, and if they live with anyone who's immunocompromised, lives. In addition to that, because of that, their mental health, sort of by showing up to work and they're not even, you know, they're like, Amazon can't even pay us $2 more. Like they did that for 2 months. You can choose to take a personal leave of absence, but in that instance, you're just not paid. So you have to be like financially secure in order to not show up to work. So I wouldn't say things have gotten better, no.
20,000 workers for Amazon have allegedly contracted COVID-19. What happens to those workers now?
So if you're able to prove that you've had COVID or that you have COVID, you get 2 weeks of paid leave, I believe. And a lot of people who get coronavirus, the effects of it on you last much longer than 2 weeks. And so people don't feel like that is sufficient. I think the part that Amazon, which is obviously the harder part about this, is that what if your family member gets COVID? I think there are a lot of other scenarios that are Amazon isn't accounting for in a way that makes workers feel safe.
Amazon workers have also tried to unionize. Lauren, where do those efforts stand?
As you can imagine, the injured people are working at such high rates, especially last week, which was Prime Day week. And then in the next few months during Cyber Monday, some of the like worst weeks in terms of productivity being super high and like workplace injuries, serious injuries doubling. And so as you can probably imagine, people really think that one of the best ways to improve their conditions is to unionize and to sort of create workplace protections, because Amazon hasn't been able to do that for them by having a contract that sort of lays out some of these things. So there is an active campaign in Staten Island that is with the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Union Store Union. There has never been, so no Amazon warehouse workers in the country and no Amazon workers anywhere in the country have unionized. But beyond that, there are, you know, smaller campaigns where unions are working with organizers or warehouse workers, not necessarily on an active campaign, but sort of leading up to that. So there's workers who have organized in Chicago, in the Chicago, greater Chicagoland. There are organized warehouse workers. I would say some of the best organized warehouse workers are in Minnesota. There's a group called the Awood Center, which is a sort of East African, mostly Somalian worker center. There are workers organizing in Sacramento, in the Inland Empire in California, which is sort of Amazon's hub in California. It's interior of Los Angeles. I think those are the big ones, but we're nowhere near having a union for Amazon workers.
Lauren Kaori Gurley is a staff writer at Motherboard. Lauren, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
We're continuing to talk about Amazon, and now a former Amazon worker. Chris Smalls worked for Amazon for just under 5 years and most recently worked at a facility in Staten Island. But when the COVID-19 pandemic reached their warehouse, Chris began organizing his fellow workers to demand better conditions. After staging a strike in late March, the company fired him for allegedly violating social distancing guidelines. Now, Chris joins me, and he's the founder of the Congress of Essential Workers. Chris, thanks for being with me.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you for having me.
So, Chris, tell me a little bit about what the working conditions you experienced were like in the Staten Island facility here in New York.
You know, I've been with the company since 2015, opened up 3 buildings for them, started them from New Jersey, spent some time in Connecticut, and then I launched a building in Staten Island when it first opened up. You know, I've been with the company since I was a level 1 entry before I was promoted up to a supervisor role. So I know the ins and outs of what Amazon workers go to on a day-to-day basis. You know, I used to tell my new hires when they came into the building, you know, if you have a gym membership, you might want to cancel it, because it's definitely 10 hours of calisthenics. You know, you're up and down on ladders, you're pulling, you're reaching, you're walking miles on top of miles a day. It's ran on productivity. So what separates Amazon from its competitors is the fact that as soon as you clock in, you're on the clock until you clock out. So, you know, the working condition there, you know, was definitely strenuous on your body. And I always used to say that it was 90% mentally and 10% physical, because you have to mentally prepare yourself to come to work every day.
So you were there at the peak of the pandemic, which here in New York was around March. Why did you begin organizing? What were you starting to see, Chris?
So just taking me back down to late February, early March, I seen my coworkers and my employees get sick on a daily basis. I was just being a concerned supervisor and a concerned parent. You know, I have kids, twins at home, and, you know, I didn't want to bring this deadly virus home. And I'm watching the news and I'm seeing this virus sweep the nation. And as it transitioned into New York and New Jersey, we weren't doing anything as a company to protect ourselves. We weren't protected at all. We had no facial masks. We had no cleaning supplies. We had no real guidance on how to protect the workers that was coming there. So, you know, I went through the proper channels at first. You know, I went to my local HR and I'm like, hey, what are we doing to protect ourselves? And what about single parents? Can we stay home? And that was the only thing they really offered was, you know, to stay home if you feel sick. If you're, you know, you don't want to come to work, you can stay home without being reprimanded for. So it wasn't enough for me because, you know, as a supervisor working with these associates for 40, 50, 60 hours a week, they're my extended family too. So yes, I did stay home for a few days, but at the same time, I was thinking about everybody else that's coming in and out this building. It's 5,000 people. And New York became the epic center, like you mentioned, in March. And I'm like, what are they going to do? So when I noticed that they didn't really have a real plan, that's when I decided to take further action. I started fighting behind the scenes at first, though. I sent out emails to the health department, to the CDC of New York, to Governor Cuomo's office, you name it, I tried to do it. I tried to get some media involved. And when New York was the epic center, I didn't get anything. I didn't get any response. You know, everywhere was overwhelmed. So that forced me to take even more action. I returned back to work on March 24th. That's when we learned about our first case that happened in the building over a week and a half ago on March 11th. And I was like, that's very alarming that you're just now telling us. And what are we going to do? Are we closing the building down? And that's when I was told by my higher ups that we're not going to do anything and don't tell any of the employees anything. And that was the last time I worked for the company. I took my stance right then and there. An hour later, I left the building. I texted my manager that day, told him I'm not coming to work the rest of the week as a supervisor. You don't have to replace me. And when I came back to the building the following days, the rest of the week, I sat in the cafeteria off the clock for 10 hours a day on my own free will, telling all the employees that I came in contact with the truth, that Amazon didn't want y'all to know that you're possibly working next to somebody with this virus. That definitely started up a little organizing right there. I got some groups to walk with me to the general manager's office, voice our concerns all week. And at the end of the week, they decided to just quarantine me. And I knew right then and there, when they quarantined me and nobody else, not even my my person that I ride to work with, my friend that I ride to work with, I knew that I was being targeted to be silenced, to stop organizing workers and stop telling the truth.
Chris, you were fired from Amazon, at least, you know, because in your opinion, because you were organizing. You've now started the Congress of Essential Workers. What is that?
Yes. The Congress of Essential Workers, this group that I founded throughout the course of my journey, it pretty much came together around May 1st. It's a collective of workers, former, current Amazon employees. Some are other essential workers. You know, they have different talents and they come from different corporations. Some are teachers. Some are students. Some are just regular people. You know, this group came together when they pretty much believe in the fight that I was fighting against the company, and they decided to just join forces with me. And on May 1st was our first demonstration as a collective. We did a nationwide protest against Amazon on May Day, and that resulted into Tim Bray, one of the VPs of Amazon AWS, the top VP at the time, engineer, he resigned. And that's when I knew that, you know, the power of people and the power of organizing workers was really working. And our, you know, it was small victories mattered for us. So one thing I would like to highlight as well, you know, a week after I was fired, Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world, you know, he had a meeting about me with his top general counsel, David Sapolsky. And in that meeting, a leaked memo that came out and hit the media was, Jeff Bezos was trying to run a smear campaign on me that he signed off on, saying that I was not smart or articulate, and to make me, ironically, to make me the face of the whole union effort, union organizing efforts against Amazon. They gave me a great idea by saying that, but just to know that this man, the richest man in the world, was really going to try to run a smear campaign on me, really motivated me to really continue the fight that I have till this day. And I was able to find this amazing group of people. We've been able to organize with other alliances across coalitions across the country. Once again, our vision as an organization is to get enough workers' power, starting with the workforce of Amazon, who has 600,000 nationwide, get this workers' power behind us so we can negotiate a rank and file democracy, something like a union-like structure where we're now negotiating our demands that we want, you know, $30 an hour minimum wage, free Medicare, child care, you know, PPE to be provided by the company at all time. Hazard pay. We're still dealing with this pandemic and Amazon took away the $2 hazard pay. We want that back. And we also want, you know, overtime for any hours over 40. And we want to have paid medical leave, something that they don't have unless you get the virus and you get, you know, quarantine pay, which is only a percentage. So it's not enough. This and ultimately, we want to absolutely have a wealth tax on the 1% in the country, starting with Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world.
Chris, I'm wondering, in terms of the holiday season is going to be approaching us very soon. People have already been using and relying on Amazon while they quarantine and during this pandemic more so than they probably have ever in the past. And I can't imagine what the holidays are going to look like this year as more people rely on Amazon instead of having, you know, actually going to visit friends and family. What do you think the holiday season is going to look like for Amazon workers this year?
Well, the same as always, you know, business as usual, you know, and this is such a juggernaut of a company, you know, it's so hard to put a dent in their operations, even with all the boycott advocating that we've been doing. You know, they put profits above people all the time. So once again, it's going to be a very busy, probably the most busiest peak season thus far for Amazon employees. I can only imagine, you know, they're on mandatory overtime as we speak. They're just getting out over Prime Day, and it's going right into the holiday season. So I feel sorry for them, you know, because I know what they're going through. You know, they're working an extra day, or they're working an extra 2 days, or they're working an extra hour of their shift. So it's 10 hours, they're working 11 hours. So they're taking time away from people's families and just to be a service of other people, which is good as well. But at the same time, you know, to what expense? You know, you're putting a strain on your body, like I mentioned, and you're also possibly putting yourself at risk. You know, this virus is very much still here. The numbers are still spiking. The numbers are still in the building as well. The numbers, you know, there's still text that's being sent out on a daily basis saying that somebody contracted this virus, who they failed to actually disclose. You know, they failed to disclose the amount of people that's in these facilities that have this virus. They just released 6 months later the actual numbers, which I believe is way watered down. That is 20,000.
You're talking
employees.
About the 20,000 people, Chris, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, and that's very watered down. There's no way out of 600,000 you're telling me only 20,000. I don't believe that. It's way higher than what they're saying. So it's a very scary situation for workers right now. I can guarantee that.
Chris Smalls is a former Amazon worker and the founder of the Congress of Essential Workers. Chris, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me anytime.
And we should note that Amazon has defended their stance on workers' conditions in the past, saying, quote, "We take this matter seriously and it's important to us that our associates feel safe and supported. And if we find any occurrence where this has not been the case, then we will make it right." And we also reached out to Amazon for comment on this story, and their statement will be online at thetakeaway.org if we receive it. Hundreds of thousands of school-aged kids are well into another semester of remote learning as the pandemic continues to keep students out of their traditional classrooms. And while almost everyone can agree that remote learning is far from ideal, it disproportionately affects low-income students, students with special needs, and students of color. And remote learning can also be particularly difficult for students that don't speak English as their first language. There are more than 5 million English language learners in K through 12 public schools across the country, so-called ELL students, and many are at risk of being left behind compared to their English-speaking peers. So we're going to talk about what the specific challenges are that these students face with Leslie Babinski. She's the director of the Center for Child and Family Policy at Duke University and an associate research professor in the Sanford School of Public Policy. Leslie, welcome to The Takeaway.
Happy to be here.
My mom was in English as a second language teacher for many years. She ended her career about 25 years ago. How have things changed? Who are the students whose native language is not English today?
Well, it's wonderful to hear that you have direct experience with your mom as an ESL teacher. I love that. So today we know that English learners are really a very diverse group of students. They're diverse in terms of their home language, certainly, but also in terms of their level of English proficiency and in many other ways. In the U.S., about 10% of public school students are learning English as an additional language. And this percentage varies widely across states. At the high end, we have Texas and California, with about 18% and 19% of public school students who are English learners. And in at least 33 states, 6% of students or more are English learners. So really, it is quite a large group of students that we're talking about. And as you mentioned at the beginning, lots of challenges they're facing during remote learning.
For folks who aren't as familiar with the curriculum generally for students that are learning English as a second language, they are not just learning English, they're also learning core subjects, right? Like science and math in English.
Exactly. Yeah. Can you imagine learning a new language at the same time that you're being exposed to academic content in that new language? So it really is quite a challenge for teachers and for schools to help scaffold or bridge the academic vocabulary that students are trying to master in a new language so they can understand and comprehend the content of their core subjects.
So how has that curriculum been adapted to students who are learning remotely? Or has it been adapted for students that are learning remotely?
Well, as you know, remote learning is new for everyone. I don't think any of us could have anticipated that we'd be teaching our elementary school students, for example, through online learning. So it's really been quite a pivot for teachers, for schools, for parents, and certainly for the students themselves. I think some of the practices that were promising and worked well in in-person learning have been transitioned into an online environment, although there are many hurdles in getting to that point. We know that direct instruction in the English language is necessary for students to quickly acquire their new language. But we also know that collaboration between the core subjects or the general classroom teachers in elementary school, along with the ESL teacher, is what really helps accelerate students' understanding of that new content in the classroom.
And how much of English language learning is direct, as in direct from, say, a curriculum, versus more casual and in terms of, you know, their average everyday interactions?
That's a good question. Students really need both. They really need that informal peer and teacher interaction in context to help them acquire English. And they also need direct instruction in the language. So really, I mean, we're talking about kids from kindergarten through 12th grade, and so that's going to vary quite a lot. At the lower end with kindergartners and first graders, they're really emergent bilinguals, which means they're learning to read and write in both their languages. And so it's happening at the same time. So it is a very tall order for students to acquire English as they're learning academic content.
In California, the state with the largest number of non-English speaking students, some districts in the area have tried to provide additional resources. In San Francisco, for example, the city's Department of Children, Youth, and Families is offering specialized hubs in neighborhoods for low-income and English language learner students. And they're also offering in-person staff in a COVID-regulated environment to support those learners. Leslie, how vital are these additional resources?
Well, they're really essential. As you can imagine, students who are learning English along with their academic content are facing lots of challenges. For we know many of our Latino families, because of the industries that they're primarily working in, don't have the option to work from home. So we have situations where lots of young children need supervision during the day to support their learning. So these kinds of supports in the community are really essential, both for the academic progress for students, as well as their safety, their social interactions, and for economic reasons, so their parents can continue to participate in the workforce.
Your research is focusing on schools in North Carolina. What does it look like there? What are some of the challenges that students are facing there?
Yes, we are working in North Carolina in elementary schools on a teacher professional development program to support teachers learning new approaches for working with English learners. And just like across the country, we've been through several phases of reopening, and that includes our public schools. As of October 4th, public schools in North Carolina were permitted to open under Plan A, which means fully in person. Most schools started in a hybrid or fully online setting. And so now many schools are transitioning to hybrid models or bringing back subgroups of students for in-person learning. Many districts are taking a graduated, cautious approach to doing that. And that's another challenge, because now we're going back to in-person instruction, but it looks nothing like it did before the pandemic.
Leslie, I want to play a clip from Maria Sue, who's the executive director of San Francisco's Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And she's highlighting here a specific issue that's come up often with low-income students in particular, and this is the digital divide and sort of how it's playing out in San Francisco. Let's take a listen to what Maria Sue had to say.
You know, the saddest thing for us, when we realize when these children are participating in the hubs, what we're hearing from staff is that a lot of these children actually have not logged in since shelter in place happened. Because families just don't know how to, and there are no supports for these families.
Does that, Leslie, compound what the challenges that these students already face?
Oh, absolutely. We know that there are significant equity issues in making sure that all English learners have access to the education that's being provided in online learning. In our own study in North Carolina, we were working with teachers and students when the pandemic hit, and were able to follow them. And we found that teachers reported that 68% of their English learners in our relatively small study required a device from the school to be able to access online learning. And another 27% of the families needed a hotspot to access the internet. And so what we learned is it's not simply providing the hardware and the internet access to families. Can you imagine not having a computer in your home and all of a sudden needing to log on to multiple learning platforms with your student in a language that's not your home language? It's been a significant challenge, both in terms of distributing the devices and the hotspots and ensuring internet access, but also really building up that partnership with parents so they can support their children at home. And I have to say that both teachers and parents have been amazing. It's been incredible to see the dedication of our teachers in ensuring that they connected with each and every family. And likewise, parents are going through extraordinary lengths to make sure that their children are participating and benefiting from the online learning that their school is providing. We've heard stories of an example recently was a teacher was telling us that one of her kindergarten students' parents was joining all of her live lessons and bringing her cell phone with her. And she had a family member who was bilingual on the phone who was then translating the lesson for the parent so the parent could support the child after the lesson was over. Just really extreme dedication and figuring out a way to make it work, which has been really quite incredible to see.
Leslie, what about ESL teachers who are trained to teach English as a second language? Are there enough teachers to go around to focus on these populations right now?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I think any ESL teacher would tell you, no, there aren't enough ESL teachers.
There weren't back 20, 30 years ago. So that's why I'm wondering if this pandemic has exacerbated that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The funding formula supporting spending for English language learners has not kept pace with the growth in the English learners in the country. And I think any ESL teacher would tell you that they're trying to serve far too many students for the kinds of things that they know they need. And certainly post-pandemic, we're going to see a huge need for support services for many students, not just English learners, because, you know, all students are struggling, but certainly for English learners to help accelerate their growth, both in terms of the academic content and English language.
And what about parents who don't speak English as their first language? How are they navigating the space for their children who've now, parents have had to take a big role in becoming educators themselves?
That's exactly right. That's actually one of the key findings we learned from the spring. And that was teachers reported that students who had a parent at home who could support their child's learning, or another adult who could support it, or even a sibling, those students were more likely to miss less instruction. So they missed less than 2 weeks of instruction if they had a supportive adult or other person in the house who could help them. And, you know, in some cases, because I said we were working with kindergarten and first grade students, the other support, in one case at least, was coming from a second grade sibling. So we have a student who's in second grade helping his little kindergarten sister access online learning. It's been a real challenge. Only about half of the students in our study had such support at home. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of families are continuing to work outside the home as essential workers in service industries and healthcare and restaurants. And many students didn't have the support they needed from an adult at home to be able to successfully access the online learning that was provided in the spring.
Leslie Babinski is the director of the Center for Child and Family Policy at Duke University and associate research professor in the Sanford School of Public Policy. Leslie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie, Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
The coronavirus pandemic has forced many of us to reflect on the support systems in our lives. It definitely has for me. I became a new mom just a few weeks before COVID-19 tore through New York City in the early spring. And because of orders to shelter in place, my support system fell apart and I became my son's sole caretaker. The pandemic made me realize just how fragile our social networks can be. But as it continues through the fall and winter, I'm also realizing how critical those systems are to our overall survival. And I'm not the only one who's been reflecting on the help we're giving and receiving during this time.
Hi, this is Christy from Oklahoma City. I haven't been doing very well. I'm struggling to get things done outside of work. I have bipolar disorder, and it's been tough dealing with the depression from the pandemic, my own depression, and seasonal depression. I'm trying my best to reach out to others and stay connected. No one should feel alone during this time. My mental capacity has definitely felt depleted, trying to focus and be productive with everything that's going on. I'm definitely ready for this to lessen and for things to improve soon.
This is Dee Dee Tassone from San Francisco. The most satisfying thing I've done in the last 8 months was just last weekend. My daughter's grandchildren and I formed a team to volunteer for the San Francisco Food Bank. We must have filled over 100 boxes and grocery bags with food for those less fortunate. When we finished our shift, I was exhausted, but highly gratified, since I had been feeling so helpless.
For more on our support networks and coping in the pandemic, I'm joined by author Nicole Chung. Nicole recently wrote about the importance of emotional support systems for the New York Times. Nicole, thanks for being with me.
Hi, Tanzina. I'm really glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. You shared a very personal story in your New York Times piece about how you were coping after your mother passed away during the pandemic, which I will offer my condolences to that. How have you been coping since? How has that evolved?
Oh, gosh. I mean, in the early weeks, I think I was moving through stages that'll be familiar to anybody who's grieved. So, you know, there was definitely a lot of anger and there was some denial. And I think one of the things that made it really difficult to just accept what was happening was the fact that we were in a pandemic, and I felt really cut off, not just from my mother and from her caregivers across the country, but also from just my support system, you know, which is also spread out across the country. But like, I couldn't even see people who lived close by, and it was just a really tough time to figure out like how to cope and how to really stay functional in the midst of all this grief when I was feeling so isolated from everyone.
It's It's interesting that you mentioned that because our circumstances are different, but in many ways I really, what resonated to me in your piece was how you said at some point you just didn't know how to accept the help, right? That people were trying to reach out to you and it was just all too much. And I think for those of us who tend to be very self-sufficient, it is hard to accept help. How was that for you? Like to, sort of like navigating how that felt when people are trying to reach you and you're like, I don't want to do this right now.
Yeah, I mean, I was always really thankful for people who were reaching out. And at the same time, it's so hard when you can't be with people. And when you know that everyone reaching out to you is also struggling, they're also overwhelmed. Many of them also grieving something or someone. You know, I think it's wonderful that people are trying to reach out and be supportive across these connections. I have noticed like a lot of the time, really all I can do and all others can do is sort of hold that space together. Like really back to basics of empathy, like mirroring what the other person says and listening and talking about what they're telling you and how they feel, just making room for all of their emotions and giving language to it. Because, you know, we can't actually physically reach each other. And constructive advice and practical help, these are really important things too. But sometimes it can just be most helpful to let people know you hear and you're there with them. And not feel so much anxiety about whether you can concretely make things better for them.
And this idea that everybody that comes up in your piece also is sort of that people are trying to help in the ways that they can, right? And I feel like that's going both ways. Talk a little bit more about that. Like, how are people trying to help others and also help themselves and sort of find where their limits are and what they're capable of?
Well, this is where I was really grateful to get to talk with some helping professionals. And one of them, Martha Crawford, who's a psychotherapist, I think the phrase she used that I loved was that this sort of help is in the spirit of mutual aid, right? And that also comes from understanding where some of our support systems were weak already, or places where our infrastructure or our safety nets are being dismantled or are just overwhelmed. Like this spirit of emotional mutual aid that we are really who we have can be an empowering thing. To remember and to move forward with together. And so you move out of that competitive space for limited resources and feeling like, you know, I don't have that much to give, or I can't ask this other person who also might not have much to give. And then just say honestly where you're at, like, do you have the capacity to be there? And let people know that you want to be there and that you're thinking of them, and give what you have to give.
Some people done things like they've come to do socially distant laundry, which I can't tell you is one of the best things that's ever happened in my life. And yet those are things that require someone to be physically present. But when they can't be physically present, Nicole, how should people think about reaching out? How should people think about offering help? We heard from one of our callers who said, you know, she went to pack food for folks who are hungry. So what other ways can people do that when they can't be physically present?
I think, you know, one thing is just, again, being very intentional about reaching out and about, you know, it can sound sort of like administrative, but it's helped me a lot to actually make appointments with people, like to set times, because it's easy to say like, oh, we'll catch up later or we'll talk again. But I have found unless I set a time, it's too easy for that to sort of fall by the wayside when everybody is so busy and overwhelmed. You know, I think some of it too, if you're fortunate enough to have resources to share, you know, I've given and received a lot of material help over the past 7 months, and I've been really, really thankful for that. Sometimes, you know, it's hard knowing a friend is grieving far away, and I can't actually be with them. But, you know, I there are people like within my reach who are going through similar things. And, you know, sometimes if you can't be there for everyone you want to be, again, it's about finding, like identifying who is within your circle, within your reach, maybe within your community, and how you can safely be there for them, even if you can't be there for every single person. You know, I think so many people are operating in these pods, like sort of community pods or even long distance pods. And you sort of have to be able to tell like your group, your people, like when you need help. And recognize too, like a big thing for me was like, you don't have to get all the way to falling apart to ask for help. You know, you can kind of just have these check-ins and report how you're doing. If there are people you give freely to, there are people that, you know, you can also ask for help when you need.
I love this. And we're going to keep listening and asking our listeners to call up with how they're coping and asking and getting help as well. Nicole Chung is the author of the memoir, All You Can Ever Know. Nicole, thank you so much for sharing your experience.
Thank you, Tanzina.
We're going to keep coming back to this question as the pandemic roars on, but here's what we've heard so far from you.
This is Lisa from Little Rock, Arkansas. I'm very fortunate to be working. I clean houses Monday through Friday and have a part-time job on Saturday and Sunday. Two adult children, one with a baby, who are struggling. They can't pay their utilities, their car tax, and my anxiety is through the roof. Is the current government really going to kick my children to the street? They are doing everything they are supposed to be doing. We're in the South, and speaking for myself, I'm not sure I could contain myself and my children become homeless. I pray every day for all of us on this tiny planet in hopes that we can come back from this, but I'm not sure that we can.
Hi, my name is Joe Rogoff, and I'm from Burnville, California. My grandson visited a few days ago. We stayed outside, suitably separated, but didn't wear masks. He called us yesterday to tell us that one of his roommates tested positive for COVID. He was tested this morning and was told it would be 2 to 6 days for results. So, how am I coping? I imagine every cough, sniffle, unbalanced feeling to be a sign that I'm infected. The interminable duration of this virus is usually unnoticed but present weight that we're carrying. That stress seems to be showing up as an accelerator to the many tensions that already exist. It's the straw that's threatening to break my back.
Hi, this is Hannah from Levittown, and I've been working from home in a new job. I know everyone's experiences are different, but I've actually been okay because unemployment equaled near working two of my jobs, which I was working before the pandemic hit. I'm okay with paying my rent, but next month I might have to start looking at participating in one of the local food banks, and that's a little scary to me because I've never had to do that before.
And others find some aspects of life easier to cope with now than before the pandemic.
This is Suzanne from Raleigh, North Carolina. Nothing has changed in my life for the worst because of the pandemic. In fact, if anything, it's gotten better. I am now working remotely, so I don't have to commute for 8 hours a week. I've had more chance to bond with my family, my husband. I've had more time to take care of myself. I've lost 20 pounds during the pandemic so far. And, you know, I've achieved a sense of mental clarity that wasn't there when I was, you know, running around every place. I kind of am enjoying my life.
But from balancing work and homeschooling to the mental health challenges of social isolation, many people's lives have become more stressful. And for those in the service industry and the many millions who have lost their jobs during this pandemic, it's been a particularly difficult time to cope.
Hi, my name is Bella. I'm from Tacoma, Washington. I own a hair salon here. And coping with the pandemic has been tricky for all hairdressers because we have a state mandate that tells us we can only operate at 50% capacity. However, if we're operating, we then are not qualified to get unemployment or other assistance because if you make more money than the ridiculously low amount that they cap it at, you can't get assistance. You can't make your normal amount of money, and you can't operate at the level that you're supposed to unless you want to risk making people sick, getting yourself sick, or losing your license. And yet they won't do anything to subsidize that in order for us to be able to follow the mandate. And it's maddening.
And that's all for us on this Monday. Thanks so much for being with me. Keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.